I don't know what the gates of hell looks like, but this was probably it. It's something nobody should ever have to see or live through.
United 175, New York. We have some problems over here right now. We might have a hijack over here, two of them.
Report from, and what we're looking at and dealing with this morning is a plane that has crashed into the World Trade Center Tower in New York City. Some of this film is absolutely dramatic.
Just going to work that morning when we got word that a plane had hit the World Trade Center.
We're on an airplane that's been hijacked. If things don't go well, it's not looking good.
You may remember a time before 9/11, September 11th, 2001.
You can see the two towers, a huge explosion now, raining debris on all of us. We better get out of the way!
This is this generation's Pearl Harbor.
But you've likely gotten used to the changes.
You don't go to an airport the way you used to do. You don't go into a professional sporting event the way you used to.
But there were days when our freedom had a different meaning. Days that were more carefree. Perhaps more naive, and days that America didn't fully understand the level of evil that existed in an underworldly, dark realm of people who could plan and execute an attack that would kill nearly 3,000 fathers and mothers, sisters and brothers.
The class of 2018 is probably the last class to have been born entirely when 9/11 happened.
Those were the days when the tower stood tall, as did American and Hoosier resolve.
Walk back up those steps to the Capitol to stand tall and to breathe a prayer on behalf of the families who've lost loved ones and to express our resolve that this will not stand.
But in the 20 years since those attacks, America has come, in a sense, from innocence to experience.
There was not a game plan for where members of Congress should go in the event of something like this would happen.
Indiana has become in some ways stronger and hardened against that evil element.
They knew that firefighters are going to die today, and everybody knew that.
While in those days, two decades past, America held hands and held tight.
As a group, both Republicans and Democrats sang God Bless America on the steps of the Capitol.
It does often bring out the best. People, at least temporarily, are willing to set aside all the rules and regs.
Hoosiers have come to hold dear their story, an American story of surviving terror and surviving change.
And it's nice to come home. It's nice to see green grass and not soot-covered buildings and smell the smells that we smelled, the fire and the ash.
People holding up thank you signs and waving American flags greeted Task Force One.
Of the 63 of us that went to New York, 26 have become ill in various illnesses.
You're about to travel through two decades. Decades where time has taken the wounds of terror and transformed them into the hardened scars that tell the story of a continuous battle between good and evil.
The entire building has just collapsed as if a demolition team set off. When you see the old demolitions of these old buildings, it pulled it down on itself and it is not there anymore.
A battle that has brought blessings, curses, and changed the shape of the American ideal.
The explosion is incredible! Oh my God!
Another plane as we were watching.
I don't believe this! The second tower has exploded!
My prayer was that our America would always be like that. That we would care that much to sift through tons and tons of debris.
In a gargantuan explosion!
Plane activity has begun to occur at Indianapolis International Airport.
You're about to hear 9/11. The Hoosier call to courage.
Oh my God, I don't believe it!
There's nothing in life worth living for unless it's worth dying for.
Between the downtown canal and Ohio Street in downtown Indianapolis stand two steel beams. You might think the formation peculiar if you were driving by and did not know that the small plot of land was dedicated to remembering what happened on September 11th, 2001. The beams are identical, and they come from the rubble of the Twin Towers.
There's a lot of hidden meaning in the symbolism of the memorial. If you look at the beams, they're actually staggered in the same formation that the towers were built.
Greg Hess, an Indianapolis firefighter, is responsible for hauling the beams back from New York City, where he and 62 other Hoosier firefighters gave up their time and talents in the days following the attacks.
The gray granite that extends all the way to the street is the reflected images of the towers prior to 9/11. The benches that you and I are sitting on are exact replicas of those that were at the World Trade Center. The huge wall that's behind the memorial has a huge crack in it, and that's meant to symbolize that it broke us as a nation, but we did not fall. And then atop the tallest beam is a 420-pound bronze American Eagle. And he actually sits and looks back to New York City. We actually took a GPS reading to make sure that he looked in the right direction. And then the seven trees that are around the plaza are indicative of the seven buildings of the World Trade Center. And they're all indigenous to Indiana. And the largest one is called a Freedom Tree.
He has a story that has haunted him. It's haunted his life and health.
Yeah, I woke up from a colonoscopy in 2007 with stage 3A colon cancer. No family history. And through documentation and lab testing and everything like that, they were able to certify my cancer as a result of the exposures at Ground Zero. Of the 63 of us that went to New York, 26 have become ill in various illnesses, respiratory problems, numerous cancers. I was one of the fortunate ones. I only had stage 3A colon cancer. We've had two members of the team die and they were directly attributed to their exposures at Ground Zero.
The stories of those 63 firefighters are just a few of the thousands of stories that have come out of the attacks in New York City, Washington, D.C., Somerset County, Pennsylvania.
United 93, understand, have a bomb on board, go ahead. Executive 956, did you understand that transmission?
Affirmative, he said there was a bomb on board.
And that was all you got out of it also?
Affirmative, Roger.
They are stories of courage and bravery, largely sad, but stories that inspired a generation of people who witnessed those events, either on their TV screens or who lived the events in real life, in real time.
Pentagon just got hit. You don't say that. Damn, I can't protect my NCA.
20 years later, the stories have taken on a deeper meaning. They become part of the heritage of our country and our state. The attacks were the catalyst for two decades of events that have cost thousands of lives.
I feel bad for the people in Afghanistan that we've left behind, and I think the way we did it was horrible.
It's been an ongoing war and a 20-year debate over the right way and the wrong way and how to protect your freedom.
We've made an agreement with the Taliban thus far. They've allowed them to go through. It's in their interest for them to go through.
Coming up, the days before 9/11.
I ordered our armed forces to strike at terrorist-related facilities in Afghanistan and Sudan.
And the day that changed America forever. You're listening to 9/11, the Hoosier Call to Courage. Fighting in the Middle East is not a recent occurrence in the world. But on October 23, 1983, 220 U.S. Marines, 18 sailors, and 3 soldiers lost their lives in the bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut, an attack that would mark a new era of terrorism against U.S. targets, both overseas and eventually here at home.
I know there are no words that can express our sorrow and grief over the loss of those splendid young men and the injury to so many others.
You're listening to 9/11, the Hoosier Call to Courage. Not long after the bombing, then-President Ronald Reagan landed near the White House in the rain, in sorrow for the loss of 241 American lives.
But I think we should all recognize that these deeds make so evident the bestial nature of those who would assume power if they could have their way and drive us out of that area, that we must be more determined than ever that they cannot take over that vital and strategic area of the earth, or for that matter, any other part.
I would call it like a cult who is following an ideology.
Dave Medeiros was a private first class who survived the attack.
And they're building their playbook based on how we respond to certain things. And, I mean, they're taking notes.
The response to the attack may have itself been a turning point. There was no war on terror at that moment.
When the Marines pulled out in 1984, Osama bin Laden and many others were watching.
Major Bob Jordan, then spokesman for one of the companies the Marines attacked, in a documentary made by the Marines.
They had tested us militarily. They had tested us spiritually. They had tested us politically.
Nearly 40 years later, the attack by two Hezbollah suicide bombers funded by Iran is remembered, but it's largely just a shadow in comparison to the attacks perpetrated since, both on American interests in foreign nations and on home soil.
We will honor their service and sacrifice, and we will strive every day to be worthy of it.
I actually saw the wall shaking. I thought it was an earthquake or something. Like, all the computers went off. Everything just went off. It sounded like a bomb or a bang or something, like, or a pop. I can't really explain it.
In fact, it was a bomb.
We were on the 25th floor and going down till about, I'd say, the 10th flight. There wasn't that much smoke. From 10 all the way down to 1, you couldn't really see anything at all, and it was dark, and people had flashlights, and they just helped everybody out of the building.
February 26th, 1993.
The fire was concentrated in one area, in that B2 level, and what they were trying to do is to deal with the people that were trapped in the other areas because of the smoke condition in the upper floor.
A truck bomb exploded below the North Tower of the World Trade Center. When it went off, it crippled the building, immediately knocking out power.
We will go every floor.
And sending smoke and soot into the elevator shafts and into the stairwells.
Right.
Floor by floor, you have a methodical type of, search, and you make certain that you cover every area, and every elevator has to be open. We have to be certain that there's no one in those elevators.
It was tough to breathe for the people trapped in the building, trying to come down.
We're walking down dark, pitch dark, escape, stairways. There's no fresh air at all. We were up there for 2.5 hours.
The smoke made it tough to escape.
Not that long after, I'd say about 10 minutes, there were already with smoke because of some of the elevator shaft. So it wasn't smoky enough that you couldn't see, but there was definitely smoke on the floor. And there was a bit of confusion because there were no announcements. I don't remember hearing any announcements that day.
Lolita Jackson survived both the 1993 bombing and the attack on September 11th. She spoke at an event commemorating the 1993 attack put on for the 25th anniversary by the 9/11 Memorial and Museum.
And then finally, our boss just decided to start leaving. And so we sort of slowly made our way to the stairs. And the stairwells, you could not see your hand in front of your face. They were pitch black. And if you have probably heard the numbers, that 50,000 people worked in the two towers. So imagine 50,000 people going through only 6 sets of stairs. And the smoke had already started coming up the stairs as well. So for us, the most frightening part of the day was trying to get out of the building and getting down the stairs, because it took, I believe my group took 2.5 hours to get down the stairs.
The explosion was enormous. It was a urea nitrate hydrogen gas enhanced device inside the truck, which had a long fuse, which allowed the driver to get out of the underground garage before it went off. The intent was to cause the North Tower to topple, crashing into the South Tower, bringing both of them down. That part did not happen, but the damage was still massive.
We could hear some guy yelling to us on the other side of this tremendous hole. I imagine he could hear us. We were trying to make a racket. My company was trying to work around this tremendous hole to get to him. We were unable to. The structural damage is tremendous. I imagine he even had to come in from the other building or another area.
6 people died in the explosion, most of them in the vicinity of the garage. About 1,000 more people were hurt.
There was a man still sitting in his car, and you could tell he was dead. And I didn't even get close to him, because as we were getting into that area, our man got hurt, and that's what we were concerned with. But as far as I know, he was dead.
The chief architect of the bombing, Ramzi Youssef, trained at an Al-Qaeda camp in Afghanistan in 1991. He was able to enter the United States claiming political asylum from Iraq with an Iraqi passport. He was given a hearing date. In the meantime, he set up residence in Jersey City and began ordering parts and materials for the 1,500-pound bomb. He got money from his uncle, and a blind Muslim cleric, Omar Abdel Rahman, introduced him to his co-conspirators, who ultimately helped him carry out the attack, which was revenge for U.S. support for Israel and not Palestine. Youssef overestimated how many people would be inside the World Trade Center towers. He had hoped to kill 250,000 people. August 7th, 1998, nearly simultaneous truck bombings at the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania killed more than 200 people, including 12 American citizens. The response from the United States and then-President Bill Clinton.
Today, I ordered our armed forces to strike at terrorist-related facilities in Afghanistan and Sudan. Because of the threat they present to our national security.
This time, U.S. attacks had a target.
The United States launched an attack this morning on one of the most active terrorist bases in the world. It is located in Afghanistan and operated by groups affiliated with Osama bin Laden, a network not sponsored by any state, but as dangerous as any we face.
The missiles missed bin Laden to the detriment of the U.S. and the world. Just 2 years later, another plot would provide a stark and gruesome reminder that terror was alive and was being used to hurt America. A hole blasted in the side of the USS Cole.
I want to express my deep sorrow at the explosion involving the U.S. naval vessel Cole in Yemen.
Then Secretary of State Madeleine Albright.
If it turns out, as it appears, to have been a terrorist act, we will hold those who committed it accountable and take appropriate steps.
Again, it was determined that Al-Qaeda was responsible. The Cole sailed home with not only a gaping hole in her side, but a hole lined with the blood of 17 sailors, murdered in their quarters by a bomb on a raft. Sudan was held liable for the attack, and $13 million in Sudanese assets was distributed to the families of the people killed. And the attack on the Cole faded in the months that passed.
In the United States, a lot of times we fall asleep. They do something and they let it die out, you know, and we're all excited about, you know, the price of gasoline or you know, whatever the topic of the day is.
The mega corporations who own the news organizations decided it was time to cash in on the peace dividend. The only problem was we weren't at peace.
Former CBS News correspondent Tom Fenton maintains that America should have known what was coming next, were it not for the negligence of the people who ran the big news networks.
But we were never given the time, the money, or could we get past the gatekeepers to really connect the dots for you, our audience.
Coming up, September 11th, 2001. You're listening to 9/11, the Hoosier Call to Courage.
And this is a very, very simple question that everybody's going to have the right answer. What were you doing on 9/11? Where were you on that day when you found out?
You're listening to 9/11, the Hoosier Call to Courage.
And it's one of those things that's like, when's your birthday? You know, everybody remembers, I'm sure you remember where you were and what you were doing on that particular day.
I had a funny feeling that something bad was going to happen that day, and I thought it was going to happen to me. Specifically, I thought I was going to die in a plane crash.
Oh, yeah, that day, I mean, I clearly remember the morning, how beautiful it was that morning, cloud in the sky. I remember getting in early that morning.
I was in Washington, yes. I was having breakfast with Senator Lieberman, as a matter of fact.
We had just brought some airplanes back from a two-week training deployment in Nevada. Monday was a day off, so Tuesday morning was some scheduled meetings and was a relatively slow day. And with an infant, we didn't get much sleep. And I was trying to sleep in that morning because I had an evening shift. I was going to come in and work the evening.
I was meeting with some of our key staff from the Office of Management and Budget.
I was mayor of Indianapolis on 9/11. I remember I was headed to work on a routine day, or at least seemed like it was going to be a routine day, and I was stopping in on the way to work to have a blood draw taken.
Routine. You hear that word a lot. That Tuesday might have also started as a routine day for you. For the people on two flights coming from Logan International Airport in Boston, a flight coming from Washington Dulles, and a flight coming from Newark International in New Jersey, the day was far beyond routine. Their lives would be lost, and the mighty jets would become mighty projectiles. Whether you were in New York City, Washington, D.C., rural Pennsylvania, or Indiana, on that day, there was no way to be American and avoid being affected.
Don't ask me why, but I had plans to make this trip because it was part of my job.
Tina Darling of Brownsburg had a bad feeling about the day, but she had a trip to make for work from Indianapolis to Chicago and then on to Washington, D.C.
Something just kept telling me if I could get out of it, get out of it, but I couldn't. And so I just had this very, very, almost like a premonition. But I thought it was going to happen to me on my actual trip.
She made it as far as Chicago O'Hare.
And so I got to my next gate, and I see all these people standing around the TV monitor watching the news. And I didn't understand why, but I was hungry, so I sat down and I ate my bagel. And I finished eating, and these people weren't leaving. They just kept standing around, and the crowd was getting bigger around this TV set. And so I finally went up there myself.
All right, thank you very much. We're following a late-breaking story here, too, this morning. A plane has crashed into the World Trade Center tower in New York City. This is absolutely spectacular. We'll have the latest from ABC in just a matter of moments here at 1070 WIBC and from our news center, too, this morning. I'm telling you, folks, this is incredible.
8:46, the first plane hit. Besides the hijackers, there was a crew of 11 and 76 passengers on board. It left Logan at 7:59. Mitch Daniels, who would later be governor of Indiana, recalls getting the news while working on the federal budget at the White House as a member of the Bush administration.
I happened to be looking into the outer office. There was a TV that was generally on to one of the news stations, and I saw, you know, a big tower, smoke, and so forth. And somebody came in and said what had happened. My top deputy at the time had a long history in defense, and he and I looked at each other and said, you know, that's not likely an accident.
I made my way up from the ground floor using elevator banks up to the 57th floor to start my day.
John Baxo is from Dyer, Indiana. He was working inside the World Trade Center, North Tower, temporarily for a week for a law firm.
And then at 8:46, like you said, Flight 11 impacted the floors above me. Where I was standing, I was actually standing in a computer room. I remember when the plane hit, the explosion. I thought it was an explosion on the floor above me, but I thought to myself, there cannot be an explosion on the floor above me because there's people above me. There's, you know, workers up there.
This is breaking news from the WIBC News Center.
Live report from, and what we're looking at and dealing with this morning is a plane that has crashed into the World Trade Center Tower in New York City. Some of this film is absolutely dramatic, and I've never seen anything like this, and we're going to get the latest from ABC in just a couple of seconds here. Again, this story just broke as we're taking those calls on Michael Jordan and whether or not he should retire. But this, again, some real drama from New York City this morning.
And the phone rang at, around a little after 9, as I recall. And I looked at the caller ID, and I was like, man, I want to get some sleep. So he just kept calling. And finally, I answered the phone, and I said, what?
Kevin Brown was an air traffic controller at the time at the Indianapolis International Airport. He had a new baby, a daughter, and he was trying to sleep in.
And he said, you got to turn on the TV, and he hung up. So I turned on the TV, and it was after the first airplane had gone into the World Trade Center. And they kept saying small aircraft had hit the World Trade Center, and they zoomed in on that hole, and it was a crystal clear day, and I immediately could tell that's not a small aircraft. But I couldn't, like everybody else, I couldn't really figure out in my head, how did anybody hit that building on accident on a crystal clear, beautiful fall morning? So it really didn't process right.
Barron Hill of Seymour was serving as a Democratic congressman from Indiana at the time and was having breakfast with Senator Joe Lieberman.
And we'd heard about the first plane coming into the building and didn't think much about it, just thought it was, you know, an accident. Later found out it wasn't an accident, of course.
He says he never entertained the thought right at the beginning that it might be a terrorist attack.
Actually, I didn't. I thought it was just an accident. And like a lot of people in my office there, when I got through with breakfast with Senator Lieberman, I walked back to my office, and nobody in the office was really that concerned about it.
Nobody was flying when the
happenings, you know, between 8 o'clock and then into the 9 a.m. time frame happened. We were not flying yet.
Retired Colonel Chris Colbert of the 181st Fighter Wing based in Terre Haute.
I was sitting in a meeting and someone came to the door and knocked and said, hey, I think you may need to see what's going on. They were watching TV out in the lounge, preparing to get ready to brief and go fly later on. So we came outside and actually saw the aftermath of the first tower being hit.
This is live coverage from ABC News. I'm Jim Hickey. An airplane has crashed into the upper levels of one of the twin towers of the World Trade Center in Lower Manhattan in New York. A tremendous amount of smoke is billowing from the upper levels of that tower. There is a gaping hole. Actually, there are two gaping holes in two sides of that building. Several windows have been blown out. There is no word yet on casualties. We have this eyewitness who told us what he saw.
Hello.
Okay,
my name is Brian Lutz. I'm about 10 blocks away north of the Empire State of the World Trade Towers. I was looking at the Trade Towers exactly when it happened. I heard this incredibly low noise, and I knew something horrific was about to happen. I dove away from the window, not to be shattered with glass if it was a huge explosion. Within seconds after not having the glass blow into me, I looked back up. There was an incredible billowing wall of fire that shot up, almost obscuring the lower third of the radio tower, which would have been about a 20-story, 25-story ball of flame.
Tina Darling, heading for D.C. for a work trip, had left Indianapolis and was at her gate at the Chicago O'Hare Airport. On the TV screen, the North Tower of the World Trade Center was on fire.
And I said to the guy next to me, because I couldn't tell what it was. All they were showing was the top half of the Trade Center towers on the TV. So I didn't recognize it right away. And the guy next to me said, a plane just flew into the World Trade Center, and they don't know why, and they don't know what happened. And so I thought to myself, well, it was somebody in a private little two-seater airplane who somehow got off track. This is a tragic accident, and, you know, it'll be interesting to see what they learn.
What happened in the next few minutes would leave little doubt in most people's minds what was going down on American soil.
He got up out of his hotel suite this morning, was about to leave. Reporters saw the White House Chief of Staff, Andy Card, whisper into his ear. The reporter said to the president, do you know what's going on in New York? He said he did.
Coming up September 11th in Washington, D.C.
Capitol Hill police urged me to leave the Capitol ground.
You're listening to 9/11, the Hoosier Call to Courage. You're hearing actual sounds from the construction of the World Trade Center towers in 1969.
Take these people here working on these scaffolds on the outside of the building. I'd like to see Mr. Nixon put a 40-hour week on the outside of this building during the winter months.
No sooner has one New York skyscraper risen above its neighbors than another is on its way to reach a little higher. In 1966, this area was raised to make way for the towers of the World Trade Center. In 1969, from 70 feet below street level, the first tower rose toward its 1,350-foot destination. The unique tower design permitted many building activities normally accomplished in sequence to take place at the same time. Large open areas free of columns are a major feature of the tower buildings. Closely spaced vertical columns provide the load-bearing strength instead of the customary interior steel skeleton. In late 1970, the last piece of steel for the tower was hoisted over a quarter mile into position atop New York's tallest building. The North Tower of the World Trade Center was topped out in December 1970. The South Tower was completed in 1971.
You're listening to 9/11. The Hoosier Call to Courage.
The cockpit's not answering. Somebody's stabbed in business class.
Flight attendant Betty Ong.
And I think there's mates that we can't breathe. I don't know. I think we're getting hijacked.
Is that American 11 trying to call?
Buddy.
We have some planes. Just stay quiet and you'll be okay. We are turning to the airport.
And who's trying to call me here? American 11, are you trying to call?
Nobody moves. Everything will be okay. If you try to make any move, you'll danger yourself and the airplane. Just stay quiet.
Just minutes later, at 8:46, the North Tower of the World Trade Center was hit by that plane. It hit so hard that it disappeared into the building, leaving huge holes and a lot of fire and smoke.
I just couldn't imagine what it was. Then when the explosion got closer to my floor and started rattling my floor and shaking, you know, all the computer equipment in my room, then it really started to sink in that something seriously was going wrong with that building.
Hoosier Don Baxo from Dyer, Indiana, recalls when the building he was in was hit, he was on the 57th floor.
When you were taught during a fire alarm in school or whatever is to use the stairs and never use an elevator, well, that resonated through my head that morning was try to find the closest stairwell, you know, after the impact. You know, after the explosion came through my floor and the building started to sway back and forth and then it came to center, I thought to myself, I have got to find the closest stairwell. And I did. I found the closest stairwell, which was right around the corner from where I was working. And I was probably in that stairwell within less than 5 minutes after the impact.
It's packed, but everyone is calm. The conversations fly about what had hit the building. Brian Lutz is on the phone with ABC News, which is being heard live in Indianapolis on WIBC. He's on a cell phone about 10 blocks away from the Twin Towers.
Were you able to tell us the size of the airplane? Was it a small plane, a commercial plane? Do you have any idea at all?
I will tell you from the size of the gash that the wingtip had to be at least 150 to 200 feet wide. Oh, my God!
Oh,
the next building
is another one.
Oh, my God! Oh, my God!
Another plane just flew in.
I feel the heat! The explosion is incredible! Oh, my God!
Another plane as we were watching.
I can't believe this! The second tower has exploded from about the 20 stories below in a gargantuan explosion. Oh, my God! I don't believe it!
Brian Lutz there on the scene as we were talking. You just heard it.
I was looking at it. The side, the northeast corner has exploded in the most incredible explosion. Flames are flying out of the building. They're 5-10 stories high now. Black billowing smoke. The building corner, the whole entire corner is gone. It's missing.
Nobody was leaving watching the TV set. Everybody was still standing around watching it.
Tina Darling of Brownsburg was waiting for a connecting flight from Indianapolis to D.C. at Chicago O'Hare. She had had a bad feeling about flying that day, but had to go for work.
And I said, so what happened? Do they know what happened? And the guy said, and by this time you could see that the second plane had hit. And they said, yeah, they think this was a terrorist attack on the United States. And that's when my stomach just fell. And that's when I realized what my premonition was. Sorry, it's emotional for me still. And I just didn't know what to do. And I think that was the feeling of everybody around me, is that we didn't know what to do. None of us had ever experienced anything like this.
I think my boss had her TV on. People had been alerted that there was this incident.
Jerry Larson, a Hoosier who was working for the Salvation Army in Des Plaines, Illinois, near Chicago.
So shortly after after it all started, my boss came down to find me in my office. And her question was, what are we going to do? And I said, well, we're going to stay in touch with the Salvation Army Greater New York Division and see what they want the other territories to do to help in this situation.
I couldn't tell what carrier it was, and it hit the building. And I knew then it was an intentional attack. So I threw on some clothes, and I lived at Eagle Creek at the time, and I drove to the building.
Kevin Brown was an air traffic controller at Indianapolis International Airport.
There were headlights as far as I can see, and I knew it was truly hitting the fan when I walked in the building, and I walked up to Mark in the radar room, and I grabbed my headset, and I just said, hey, where do you want me to go? And I would describe it. People have asked me, what was it like? And I always describe it the same way. It was organized chaos.
We did do some pre-preparation knowing that something was probably going to happen and we might be required to fly.
Retired Colonel Chris Colbert, who was with the 181st Fighter Wing in Terre Haute.
Here in Terre Haute, Indiana, we happen to be the only munitions storage facility in the Midwest for Air National Guard units. So we actually, we were the only unit in the Midwest that had live missiles and bullets that we could load on airplanes. So our fantastic wing commander, or retired Colonel Gary Peters now, he made the decision to load up some airplanes and prepare for what we might possibly do later.
Larson, Colbert, and Brown were poised to help in their respective professions. However, they could use their skills. By 9:37 that morning, the need would be even greater.
Now, there is one report from an AP radio reporter in Washington who claims to have seen the tail of a large airliner. He says it plowed right into the Pentagon.
From ABC Radio News.
And all we know now is that there was an explosion of some sort in the vicinity of the Pentagon, and that there is now thick white and gray smoke pouring forth from the Pentagon area. People have been evacuated from the Pentagon.
I witnessed the United States Capitol literally hemorrhaging with people running in every direction.
Then Congressman Mike Pence.
I heard the deafening sounds of sirens all around and the thunderous booms of military aircraft going supersonic at low altitude. And I saw the columns of mud-brown smoke billowing out of the Pentagon just across the Potomac River.
There was no early warning system, amazingly. The warning system was somebody running through the hall saying, get out, run, don't walk. They've fixed all that since then, but it was very chaotic, and we didn't know much more than the rest of the country at that time.
Mitch Daniels, now president of Purdue University, was at the time working for the Bush administration.
So I went on out and was out in the middle with a whole lot of other people on 17th Street on the west side of the complex. And I called. I was able to get a call through. Some cell phones went down, overloaded shortly after that. But I got a call through to the fellow who was a military driver assigned to me. And I said, John, where are you? He said, I'm in my office. And I said, well, you're not supposed to be there. Everybody's supposed to be out. So he might have been the last person out. I said, look, since you're there, run, go by my office, scoop up my inbox and my gym bag and try to meet me out on 17th Street. And he got a car out there, and I got out to my little apartment on Connecticut Avenue, from which I worked the phones for a while.
Like many people that day, Daniels was preparing to improvise, to do what needed to be done. But even after three planes and three explosions, America was still in for more.
United 93, have you got information on that yet?
Yeah, he's down.
He's down?
Yes.
I'm on the 83rd floor.
Now, live, say your prayers. You got to think positive because you got to help each other get off the floor.
You're listening to 9/11, the Hoosier Call to Courage.
I got outside, all I did is I started walking east away from the buildings, but I would turn around occasionally and look at the buildings and think to myself, okay, what caused this? Why are both buildings on fire?
Two jets had crashed into the World Trade Center towers in New York City and another into the Pentagon in Washington, D.C.
I remember my staff was getting very worried. They'd peek their head into my door, into my office where I was sitting at my desk. And it dawned on me that they were worried.
Then Congressman Barron Hill.
And so I brought them all in and I said, look, you know, we're probably in the safest city in the United States, Washington, D.C. here right now because of the security. No more had I got it out of my mouth than the Pentagon got hit. And I said, forget everything I just said. You guys get home right now, right now. And they were scared. Everybody was. And Washington was panicking. And it was chaotic. People were, you know, trying to figure out what to do, and they were running outside.
Now another jet was heading in the general direction of Washington, and the radio traffic between United Flight 93 and air traffic control and the cell phone calls from the people on board made it apparent that the flight had been hijacked and that more people were in danger.
Alpha, Glenn.
I only have a minute. I'm on United 93, and it's been hijacked by terrorists who say they have a bomb. Apparently, they have flown a couple of planes into the World Trade Center already, and it looks like they're going to take this one down as well. Mostly, I just wanted to say I love you, and I'm going to miss you.
You're listening to 9/11, the Hoosier Call to Courage.
In the swirl of events that morning, I knew that Congress would need to convene to provide the authority and the resources for a national response.
Then Congressman Mike Pence.
And as Capitol Hill police urged me to leave the Capitol grounds, I simply asked where I could report for duty and was escorted to the office of the Chief of Police, where the combined leadership of the House and Senate in both parties was huddled, watching the events unfolding on several television screens in that small office.
And you can see the two towers, a huge explosion now, raining debris on all of us. We better get out of the way!
Dan Daler from ABC's Good Morning America is down in the general vicinity. Dan, can you tell us what has just happened?
Yes, Peter. It's Don Daler down here. I'm four blocks north of the World Trade Center. The entire building has just collapsed as if a demolition team set off. When you see the old demolitions of these old buildings, it pulled it down on itself, and it is not there anymore.
That should be it.
Thanks very much,
Dan. It has completely collapsed.
Those men knew the risks, understood them. And even a high-rise fire of that magnitude, an airplane into a building with that amount of fire that we had, floors of fire, they knew, and Pete said to one of my friends who was with him that day, that firefighters are going to die today. And everybody knew that.
Bobby Halton is a longtime New York Fire Department instructor and is one of the organizers of the Fire Department Instructors Conference that meets every year in Indianapolis.
Oriel Palmer was the firefighter who made it the furthest. We think he made it to about the 56th or 57th floor. But every single one of those men that climbed those stairs clearly understood the risks and clearly knew that their lives were in jeopardy from the minute they got there.
Here's the president now in Florida. I wonder if everybody knows there what's going on. We'll listen to him.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a difficult moment for America. I unfortunately will be going back to Washington after my remarks. I do want to thank the folks here at Booker Elementary School for their hospitality. Today we've had a national tragedy. Two airplanes have crashed into the World Trade Center in an apparent terrorist attack on our country.
Rather than burn to death, you'll do just about anything. So people were jumping from the 80th floor and the 90th floor to their deaths, and they were landing on the ground. That's what killed Father Judge. He got hit by a civilian who jumped, and that's how he died. He was giving last rites to another firefighter who was dying in front of him.
They know something's going
Stand
on
by,
in the world today.
They seem to have the problem at the North Tower, Peter.
Let's look at the North Tower. Quickly,
seems
quickly.
To be coming down.
Oh my God.
The second tower.
Peter Jennings on ABC News Radio.
It's hard to put it into words, and maybe one doesn't need to.
As heard live that morning on WIBC in Indianapolis.
Both trade towers, where thousands of people work, on this day, Tuesday, have now been attacked and destroyed, with thousands of people either in them or in the immediate area adjacent to them.
I never thought they would collapse.
Don Baxo from Dyer, Indiana, who was working temporarily in the World Trade Center for 1 week. He had walked down the stairs 57 flights and gotten out.
I thought, okay, the New York Fire Department, you know, highly trained, they're going to come out, they're going to come over here, you know, and get up there and put those fires out, you know, and it'll be over with. But I never could imagine in my lifetime that both buildings would collapse.
Now we're getting a report from the Associated Press that a large plane or multiple large plane crashes in western Pennsylvania. We're getting this from officials at Somerset County Airport in Pennsylvania. The only line we have now, large plane crashes. Rather, a large plane crashes rather than multiple large plane crashes in western Pennsylvania. If this is indeed connected to what has happened here this morning, it is quite clear that the United States is under attack.
The at the crash at 10:03 of Flight 93 in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, the attack or the attacks were over. But the crises in New York, Washington, D.C., and Somerset County, Pennsylvania would mean the call for dignity, service, and courage was on. And Hoosiers like Colonel Chris Colbert with the 181st Fighter Wing in Terre Haute, Jerry Larson with the Salvation Army, Air Traffic Controller Kevin Brown, then Congressman Barron Hill and Mike Pence, and then Budget Director for the Bush Administration, Mitch Daniels, were already answering that call. And the country's need may never have been greater.
When you walked outside, I mean, there were literally tens of thousands of people wandering around trying to figure out where to go. And members of Congress were in that crowd.
Coming up.
So they had ordered the ground stop, and airplanes were being forced down to land at the nearest available suitable airport. Well, that puts Indy right as a prime target for diversions.
We've had 60 diverted aircraft. We have literally parked them all over the airport.
And Indianapolis had the most divert aircraft of any airport in the country.
And more than 60 firefighters from Indiana suit up and set out for the unknown with their seemingly fearless companions.
Besides the firefighters, specially trained search dogs are also making this trip.
We're taking actually four dogs, a team of four, and a team manager for them.
You're listening to 9/11, the Hoosier Call to Courage.
I was in uniform, and I was sitting in the back right-hand seat of a Saab 340 getting ready to go to Pittsburgh to start work. It was in the morning, as we all know, and it was completely full. I was the last person to get on as a non-rev, and sitting there, and the engine never started, and the delay kept on going and going more.
You're listening to 9/11, the Hoosier Call to Courage.
And we're all looking at each other and trying to figure out what was going on. Then finally, we were told, informed, and educated on what was happening at that time, which was pretty eerie, to be honest with you.
Pilot Andy Yergler of Fort Wayne was about to take off to go to Pittsburgh for his work day.
That was at the Fort Wayne Airport. They just asked us to deplane. We went into the terminal, and then somehow the newswire had relayed what was going on, and then you know how humans are. They start talking to each other and giving each other updates, and I think it was back in the terminal shortly after I got off the airplane that I really figured out what was happening.
He drove home.
Let's return now to Peter Jennings.
West to east in the United States, there are no airplanes taking off that are at least under the control or are obeying the Federal Aviation Administration.
The order had been given for airplanes to land, but that took quite a bit of time to bring, you know, all of the aircraft in the United States to have them land somewhere where there was room for them to park. So, you know, it took a few hours for the airspace to be cleared.
Retired Colonel Chris Colbert of the 181st Fighter Wing in Terre Haute.
So it was a couple hours before myself and Tom Sims, Avon, took off from Terre Haute. And our mission, even though it was a little bit gooey, we really didn't know what was going on. We knew that we were going to take off from Terre Haute and then go fly to Chicago, of which was the Sears Tower, the Hancock Tower now, that was a very tall building and a couple of busy airports in Chicago, that we would go there and orbit over Chicago and keep our eyes out for anything that you know might be wrong or any airplanes that might be flying.
We've had 60 diverted aircraft, 60 diverted aircraft, come into Indianapolis Airport. We have literally parked them all over the airport.
The early morning departure bank that comes out of the East Coast heading westbound was roughly an hour to an hour and a half into their flight, which puts them directly over the Midwest.
Kevin Brown was an air traffic controller who worked at Indianapolis International Airport.
So they had ordered the ground stop, and airplanes were being forced down to land at the nearest available suitable airport. Well, that puts Indy right as a prime target for diversions. And Indianapolis had the most divert aircraft of any airport in the country. And it was the process was just starting to unfold.
He dropped what he was doing at home when he saw what was happening and came into work, knowing he likely would be needed.
I had been to Indianapolis. I was probably in about the seventh year of my career here. So I was comfortable working busy traffic. I'd worked a number of race days. I'd worked a number of special events. I knew what the facility looked like and sounded like and felt like when it was running at full capacity. But this was way beyond that.
Somehow in the chaos, he and his colleagues were able to safely bring down all of the aircraft that needed to land in Indianapolis. But that meant thousands of people would not get where they were going. At least not yet.
We estimate, based on the size of the aircraft, that there were probably somewhere between 5,500 and 6,000 passengers on those aircraft. It could even be a little higher than that. There were some wide bodies, and there might have been, you know, larger loads.
The Red Cross opens shelters to anyone who needs them, and it is those folks who are stranded. It is their choice as to what they want to do. I don't know what other folks may have done. They may have just elected to either stay at the airport, go to local hotels.
The airport became a makeshift hotel, motel, and campground.
Basically, we needed to get the supplies from our warehouse, such as cots, blankets, pillows, sheets, things like that, the essentials for folks to be able to spend the night or several nights, and truck it out there to the camp and set it all up.
The couple was going to Las Vegas for a few days. Now, as for his flight, his was in Newark on Tuesday morning.
Two planes behind us. That was the hijacker's plane.
That was according to the pilot.
Because I was looking at my watch. They left at 8:01. We left maybe about 4 or 5 minutes before that. And we didn't know why we had to land down here, but now I know.
He considers himself and his wife very lucky to be alive. John Bartholomew, WIBC News.
We talked about what our reaction might be. We evaluated the information that we had. And one by one, each of our folks stepped out to take care of a particular responsibility. So that's at one point the fire chief left, another point the police chief left, the public safety director left, my staff chief left.
Bart Peterson was mayor of Indianapolis, a city with tall buildings, war memorials, many possible targets. He suddenly found himself alone in the chaos.
Dawned on me I was alone, and I had this strange feeling that I was the only person in the world that knew this was happening, because I happened to be standing there alone. It's as strange as that sounds. Of course, I collected my wits after a moment or two and ran out to find out if what I had just witnessed had really happened. It was so unbelievable.
Let's go right now to WIBC's Tony Feltz, who is standing by, been monitoring the situation at the city-county building in downtown Indianapolis and also at the federal building here. Tony, what can you tell us?
City and county offices coordinated the closing of the city-county building. The city-county building closed just after 10 o'clock. The mayor says that employees were sent home out of deference to the victims of these attacks.
Let's go to the State House. WIBC's Eric Berman has been following developments there. Eric?
Well, Steve, the State House remains open and open for business. However, it is a little bit harder to get to. The state police have set up a roadblock coming off West Street onto the access road, which lets you park next to the State House and the two government center buildings, north and south, the two limestone towers.
While leaders of cities like Indianapolis and Fort Wayne had to step up and discuss the possibility of attack, Washington, D.C. had actually been under attack. Then Congressman Mike Pence had asked not to leave the Capitol, but rather to find out what he could do. He had been escorted to the office of the Chief of Capitol Police, where congressional leadership had been watching and discussing the events of September 11th.
When I arrived in the room, the congressional leaders were standing apart, divided by party and by their respective institutions. But as that fateful morning wore on, everything changed. Faced with a merciless attack on our nation, the politics of the room dissolved. There were no Republicans in that room. There were no Democrats. There were just Americans. I watched as leaders set aside every divisive issue before the Congress and made plans to move resources and programs designed to meet the moment with bipartisan resolve.
I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you. And the
You know, Washington is such a partisan city that partisanship, that partisan feeling evaporated.
Barron Hill, then a Democratic congressman from Indiana.
We were all Americans. We weren't Republicans. We weren't Democrats. We were just Americans. And we were pulling for one another. And the partisanship completely disappeared. And that was kind of a nice thing to feel in Washington, D.C. for a change.
We in the national legislature can send a message to the world that America will prevail, that those who are guilty of these acts will be brought to swift and certain and violent justice.
We therefore here in Britain
stand shoulder to shoulder with our American friends in this hour of tragedy. And we, like them, will not rest until this evil is driven from our world.
I think it would be an important statement to the world for us to walk back up those steps of the Capitol, to stand tall and breathe a prayer on behalf of the families who've lost loved ones, and to express our resolve that this will not stand.
Now, as we got later on in the day, and it was obvious that the attack was finished and over with, then we went back to the Capitol. I met my colleagues, and we actually met on the back steps as a group, both Republicans and Democrats, and sang "God Bless America" on the steps of the Capitol.
You're listening to 9/11, The Hoosier Called to Courage.
I spoke to my husband earlier in the evening. He is a search team manager and an Indianapolis firefighter. And he has just said that he's never seen anything like it. He's totally speechless.
In the hours after 9/11 and the days after the buildings fell and the Pentagon was left smoldering and investigators searched the wreckage in Pennsylvania, Hoosiers found ways to help.
Marion County Search and Rescue spokesman Bill Bashiel.
The task force is primarily made up of all firefighters from all the different fire districts here in the county, headed up by Mark Rapp of the IFD. Of the Indianapolis Fire Department.
Bashiel says besides the firefighters, specially trained search dogs are also making this trip.
We're taking actually four dogs, a team of four, and a team manager for them.
Bashiel says once FEMA deploys the team in New York, they'll work in 12-hour shifts. Lee DeNoon, WIBC News.
You're listening to 9/11, The Hoosier Call to Courage.
Go on instinct, start looking for people. But I don't know if anybody's really trained for something like that.
Trained for something in the fire service of that magnitude would almost be impossible.
Chris Majors is a captain with the Indianapolis Fire Department.
Because if you threw that scenario in a training scenario and said, here's what's happened, guys. You've got two planes that have hit these two buildings. These buildings are each 110 stories high. And now you have to figure out how to solve this problem. It's beyond comprehension. They were doing what they were trained to do, though. It was, to them, it was a high-rise fire. It was just magnified by 100.
Now, more than 60 Hoosier firefighters were on the way to comb through the rubble of those buildings.
We're not very well known, and we like it to be that way. One reason for that is that when we took off that day, our mission was not to escort Air Force One.
Retired Colonel Chris Colbert and Tom Sims from Avon were orbiting in Chicago in F-16s on 9/11, the only planes, the only noise in an otherwise completely silent sky.
So we're nowhere in documentation or on paperwork that these two F-16s from the 181st in Terre Haute, Indiana, were tasked to with the protection of the president in Air Force One. That's just something that happened.
They were with the 181st Fighter Wing in Terre Haute, and their mission had been to protect the skyscrapers and the people of Chicago. Now, that was changing.
So the short version of the story is that there were four airplanes that had been escorting Air Force One from Florida to Louisiana to Nebraska. The president had decided very quickly, I guess, in Nebraska to not stay there and to leave. And now, 20 years later, not that I would ever get in trouble for saying this, but basically the president decided to leave and they left their escort airplanes back in Nebraska, or at least behind.
The men got a call from a controller saying they were to intercept and be ready to escort an aircraft called Angel Flight, which was, at the time, code for Air Force One while it was in the sky.
So we really didn't know it was Air Force One until we probably got within about 20 miles of it and could see that it was a large airplane. And then we got a little closer and we could see that it was blue and white. And then we got even closer, close enough to be able to read that the United States of America, and we figured out pretty quickly that it was Air Force One.
Air Force One, for the safety of the president, had been from Florida to Louisiana, then to Nebraska, and then headed back to D.C.
How in the world did it get there? Why is it there? We didn't have a clue in the world, what might be happening there. But we knew that we did have the ability to protect that airplane. You know, most people prior to that would think that Air Force One is pretty safe, flying within the boundaries and the skies of the United States. And, why would Air Force One need escorted? Well, the question of the day was, just many hours before that, we also thought that the two tallest buildings in our nation were pretty safe.
By that evening, I was in a makeshift office. We'd set up some phones in the Roosevelt Room.
Mitch Daniels, later to be Indiana's governor and Purdue's president, was the director of the Office of Management and Budget for the Bush administration.
And we were I was talking to cabinet secretaries, trying to get them to guess what they might need to respond and react. And I was there when I heard the feet tramping down the hall, and that was the president on his way back in to address the nation from across the hall in the Oval Office.
9/11 would present fiscal and financial challenges for the country, and much of that would be filtered through Daniel's office.
In the immediate aftermath of that, I got, OMB got some significant assignments. Of course, first of all, to organize all the emergency funding for response for the military action, which cleaned the Taliban out of Afghanistan, for the rebuilding of New York City, the compensation of the victims. The indemnification of airlines was one of the most complicated things. The airlines couldn't fly because no one would insure them. Congress had to quickly act to create backstop insurance so that planes could fly at all. It was an amazing time of bipartisan agreement.
If a man is hungry,
give him food to eat.
If a stranger's thirsty,
give him drink.
If you're looking to pitch in and strengthen our country, as well as help the victims of senseless violence, please pick up the phone and call the Salvation Army.
Jerry Larson of Indianapolis, who was helping manage the Salvation Army Central District, had a big job once 9/11 went down.
The Central Territory, which is what I was, where I was working, was asked to set up a 24/7 hotline for people that were in any way affected by this tragedy to call, and we would have counselors standing by. We, of course, would have those who could pray with them if that's what they wanted. And so my initial responsibility was to start gathering people to set up the call center for us and people to staff the call center for us and somebody to manage the call center for us. And we did that within about 72 hours.
But he wouldn't be around long to help manage the call center. He was called to New York City to be part of the financial management team there.
Well, I wonder what it is like to get a call from somebody who has been affected, with something like that, and to actually sit with them and pray with them on the phone.
Well, we had very well-trained counselors and officers and volunteers who were capable of being good listeners. A lot of the calls that came in early, of course, were prayers from people in New York who had family who they eventually found out were tragically taken by this. At the time that they called the call center, it was more to say, would you pray for my brother or my husband or even my child? We don't know whether they survived this or not.
And as the work happened, the shock started to wear off. Flights began to happen again, and the Indianapolis International Airport had a huge task to perform, moving all of the airplanes that had landed there and parked.
So I walked outside, and as far as you could see, there were airplanes. Now, these folks had landed at an airport they weren't intending to. there were, you know, 100, 150 airplanes of air carriers that do not land here. I remember seeing Turkish Air, Aer Lingus, you know, China Air, people that were going transcontinental. Those airplanes aren't supposed to be here.
Kevin Brown was an air traffic controller.
So it wasn't like you could just throw this switch back on and resume normal scheduled operations for United, American, Southwest, or whoever. They had to ferry flight all of those airplanes from where they did land to where they needed them to resume normal commercial operations. So it was just a logistical nightmare to untangle that, what I call that knot of airplanes.
Jets are flying into and out of Indianapolis International Airport. Spokesman Dennis Rosebro says people stranded in places they hadn't intended are now getting on their way.
The Continental manager just stopped me on my way up and said that all of the diverted aircraft were now out of here.
Security measures are being strictly enforced with searches of luggage at the check-in counter. Lee DeNoon, WIBC News.
And then the firefighters came home.
You don't appreciate what you've got until it's gone. And those people, for those people in New York City, it's all gone. And it's nice to come home. It's nice to see green grass and not soot-covered buildings and smell the smells that we smelled, the fire and the ash. So we're real happy to be home.
Coming up, the price to pay for courage.
They were breathing in the bad stuff. Some of them have paid for it. Some are still around, but they've had to go through hell to get to where they are now.
And what Hoosiers have done to remember.
Those families, they need to know what their family member did.
I am so proud of the design work that happened.
You're listening to 9/11, the Hoosier Call to Courage.
Well, I don't know what we did. I think the good came out from everybody's input and the overwhelming support that New York received. And I hope that this just brings the whole America closer together.
The firefighters who went to New York had come back to Indiana.
People holding up thank you signs and waving American flags greeted Task Force One. Pike Township firefighter Gerald George says pictures and TV don't tell the whole story.
It was overwhelming. I mean, I've never been to a war, but to me it was like a war scene. And I read in the magazine today somebody's quote that said, I don't know what the gates of hell looks like, but this was probably it. It's something nobody should ever have to see or live through.
Team members also said you do appreciate what you have when you come home, like green grass after living in the dust-covered area of Ground Zero for over a week. John Bartholomew, WIBC News.
You're listening to 9/11, the Hoosier Call to Courage.
My job was public information and also to track the events and the teams as they went out.
Greg Hess was one of those firefighters.
Yeah, I woke up from a colonoscopy in 2007 with stage 3A colon cancer. No family history. And through documentation and lab testing and everything like that, they were able to certify my cancer as a result of the exposures at Ground Zero. Of the 63 of us that went to New York, 26 have become ill in various illnesses, respiratory problems, numerous cancers. I was one of the fortunate ones. I only had stage 3A colon cancer. We've had two members of the team die direct, and they were directly attributed to their exposures at Ground Zero.
And they're suffering the same things that the FDNY is going through right now with their retirees and some of the active duty members who 20 years ago were in the middle of that pile digging. And they're suffering great losses because of the after effects, the cancers and the things that are coming up.
Chris Majors, captain with the Indianapolis Fire Department.
The 10 days or I forget how long they were there, but that period of time, they were breathing in the bad stuff. And now some of them have paid for it. Some are still around, but they've had to go through hell to get to where they are now.
Yeah, I had to have 6.5 hours of surgery to remove a plum-sized tumor from my descending colon. So I have about a 10-inch scar from my belly button straight south. And then I also have neuropathy in both feet because I did 6 months of chemotherapy. And unfortunately, the chemotherapy affected my pancreas, which makes me now diabetic.
Though the problems from the debris at Ground Zero have kept Hess sick for years, he was one of the leaders in establishing the Indiana 9/11 Memorial, originally the Indianapolis 9/11 Memorial, along the canal in downtown Indy.
Well, I came across an article in Firehouse Magazine that the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, and they were charged with cataloging all the artifacts, and these are considered artifacts, these beams are considered artifacts. And they were trying to find homes for them. And so if a city or town wanted to establish a memorial, they would work with them to do that.
I will always believe that by God's grace, what our enemies intended for harm gave birth to a season of national unity and a new generation of American heroes.
With $400,000 raised through donations and land granted from the city of Indianapolis, the memorial was dedicated on the 10th anniversary, September 11th, 2011.
Let us rekindle hope and trust, and let us dream and labor for a time of understanding, harmony, and solidarity.
But just as the ground upon which the memorial was built evolved to suit the beams, the marble, and the eagle atop it all, so did the mission of the memorial.
We had lost 5,000 military people. And the truth is, we felt now we have a legitimate seat at the table.
Retired Brigadier General Stuart Goodwin, Executive Director of the Indiana War Memorials.
And so we took it to the commission, and 9-0, you know, they said, yep, we're all for it. And so we took it over. I think officially it was in 2016, something like that, 2015, 2016. And so it became part of our 25 acres of property of monuments and memorials that we take care of.
The expansion of the memorial, celebrated in 2021 for the 20th year since 9/11, includes more space and a piece of Indiana limestone from the Pentagon.
We found and were able to obtain an 800-pound piece of limestone from the wall where it was hit. Now, I think everybody knows that the Pentagon's made out of limestone. In fact, a lot of the buildings in Washington, D.C. are made out of limestone because the limestone that we have here in the state is very carvable. And that's why people like to build with it.
Goodwin says the limestone was carved and sent here and remained in a maintenance area for a while.
And so I would walk by this thing a couple times a day, and hundreds of times. And so one day I walked by it, and I looked at it at a different angle. And what happened was that I said, oh my gosh, I said, that looks like the state of Indiana.
The ironworkers, Local 22, built a stand for it, and it will have a stainless steel piece on the back in the shape of the Pentagon.
The three first responders, police, fire, EMS, we want to add a fourth, because as of the 1st of July, 7,057 service members have given their life. That's twice as many as what happened on that original day. And the reason that we think that's important is because those families that lost those service members, they need to know what their family member did and what they did to keep our, you know, to keep our country free.
But the changes in the 20 years since 9/11 have not been limited to the memorial. They've been many.
When we would fly the DC-9s, which is what I flew before, the 737, and even to a certain extent, the 737, the doors that separated the passenger cabin to the flight deck sometimes were pretty flimsy.
Pilot Andy Yergler of Fort Wayne.
But that was, I think, the first step that I remember, is they started retrofitting all of the airplanes, reinforcing those doors, putting new doors in that were much more secure, much harder to break down and break through.
He says communication improvements between the cockpit and the flight attendants came even before the implementation of Homeland Security, the TSA, and the expanded security procedures to prevent hijackings and other kinds of trouble. Chris Colbert, the retired fighter pilot who ended up escorting Air Force One.
It took many years, but as we began to have higher security in airports, including just, you know, going through the security lines, that became what most people would think was a hassle, but a necessary one.
It would have been a whole lot wiser and more responsible to fund the response, the recovery, the construction of what became the Department of Homeland Security by shifting dollars from important but lesser priorities.
Mitch Daniels, then budget director for the Bush White House. He says Congress instead borrowed the money, a pattern that's still being followed 20 years later. And his career path changed after he accomplished what he'd set out to do as a member of the administration.
When all four boxes were checked, I asked to be released from service. and came home. And at that point, I had been, I was then talked into running for governor and went off on a different errand.
And Indiana and the United States have come to live with the reality of the constant threat to our democratic republic.
What we're really interested in is to make sure that the generations that come after us, that they understand about why things happen. This event changed the way we live. You don't go to an airport the way you used to do. You don't go into a professional sporting event the way you used to. The terrorism thing has just changed everything. This is this generation's Pearl Harbor.
You know, watching the nation and many good people react aggressively and quickly to 9/11 just reminded me that whatever other objectives one has in public life, there will be emergencies, there will be crises, and you better be ready for those.
We were caught with our pants down on 9/11. You know, we did not see it coming. So I'm worried that we could be attacked again just from the fact that, you know, the Taliban is strengthened in Afghanistan.
Dedicated to the memory of the Hoosiers who died on 9/11.
Stacy Peak, born and raised in Tell City. Gary Bright, born and raised in Muncie. Karen Sue Jude, born in Bremen. Katie McCloskey, born in South Bend. Lieutenant General Timothy Mott. Colonel Buddy Boone, native of Milan.
Major Stephen Long and Mrs. Brenda Gibson, also of Indianapolis. And Eddie Dillard of Gary. Also dedicated to the people who have shared their stories of courage. And to the first responders.
These people knew exactly what the risks were. And that notwithstanding, realized that this country and their fellow citizens and their oath was more important than anything else.
Special thanks to Terry Stacy. You've been listening to 9/11, The Hoosier Call to Courage, written and produced by Chris Davis.